films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old Rockin' Chair's got me.
Old Rockin' Chair got your father.
Okay, good morning. This is Per Fogring, and the show is Fight the Empire, and we are, our guest is supposed to be Pepe Escobar, and we are trying to get him on the line right now. He is a writer. He's written books about what he calls Globalistan and Pipelineistan, and he's been writing a lot for the Asia Times, which is a wonderful news source. I recommend it highly, the Asia Times. And he also writes for other publications. And he's been writing a lot about, he's currently in Brazil. He wrote an article recently about this new BRICS Development Bank. Now, the BRICS nations, that stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. These are sort of the top of the line, sort of formerly underdeveloped nations, the rising nations in the world. And they have started their own development bank last month in Brazil. And they started this bank, which will fund sustainable global projects. They hope to have a goal of $350 billion to lend out and a big pool of reserve currencies. And this is, they are definitely a rival to the World Bank IMF combination, which has been sort of running the world or trying to run the world now ever since World War II. And they do things, they finance things like mining that destroys rainforests. And they just, and one of the things they, in Egypt, apparently in Egypt, they've been pressuring the previous Egyptian governments to go modern, more cities along the Nile, pave over the farmland and build cities. Well, what's happening now is that the Egypt used to sort of feed itself. They don't anymore. I don't know when that stopped, but they need that farmland along the Nile more than they need big modern cities. And so Egypt is in one heck of a mess. not just because of the change in governments, but because they are at the mercy of global trade. They have to import their food, and they have to, I believe they're importing oil now. They used to drill a little oil. But anyway, that's the kind of thing that the World Bank IMF funds, and this is what the this BRICS Bank is going to be kind of competing with. Oh, we have Pepe Escobar. Good morning, Pepe.
Hi, morning.
Hey,
hi.
Well, glad we got hold of you. I've been sort of holding the fort here. I've been telling about your writing, you know, your books, and for the Asia Times, and I've been and I've been going on about the BRICS Bank, which kind of organized last month in Brazil. So why don't we start with that? Tell us about the BRICS Bank.
Well, this is something that's been in the making for at least 2 years now. They have been discussing at the annual BRICS summits, and their ministers of finance as well. And finally, they made an announcement last month at the BRICS summit here in Brazil. This is I would say it's the beginning of a long and winding road, in fact. It's yet another development bank in the developing world, with a difference that unlike the Brazilian Development Bank, which is more or less the model for this one, this is multinational. The five BRICS are involved. In the, I would say, medium term, it could be open to other countries that might eventually join the BRICS, which is also evolving as a political organization as well as economic cooperation organization. And the objective, the number one objective, is to offer an alternative to the Bretton Woods system, the IMF and the World Bank, especially the World Bank in terms of financing projects in the developing world. In the beginning, the BRICS Development Bank will finance projects for companies from the five BRICS in different places, not only in the BRICS, but, for instance, in Africa. It could help Chinese, Russian, Brazilian companies. Some of them were already investing in Africa. And this could be open later on to Indonesia, Argentina, South Korea, Thailand, Turkey, countries that are, you know, mid-stage development level as well, who are in close contact with the BRICS as well, who in the future could be part of, the BRICS could expand to become almost like a new G20. In fact, they are already the most important mechanism inside the G20. So global economic decisions that bypass the BRICS, you know, it's a dead ender. It's an absolute dead ender. And obviously, this doesn't sit well with the Washington consensus crowd, especially, you know, the Washington-Brussels link or axis, let's put it this way. But it's inevitable. And in the next 3 or 4 years, I hope the bank is successful. We don't know what's going to happen, but it has all the hallmarks of a successful operation, especially for poor countries in Africa, countries in Southeast Asia later on who could, you know, get help from them, and projects of integration in South America. For instance, just an example, when President Xi from China was at the BRICS summit, he started a negotiation for Chinese companies to be involved in building something that it's been rumored about in South America for decades, which is a Pacific Atlantic railway from Brazil to Peru, which is it's mind-boggling when you think that this doesn't exist. So it would take, you know, probably the BRICS Development Bank, Chinese companies working with Brazilian companies to finally build this, which is, in a nutshell, about South American integration. Mm. So we could see a rush of projects like that all over the global south in the developing world, facilitated by the BRICS Development Bank.
Do you think they might help Argentina fight off the vultures?
Well, that's another chapter. That's different. That's about the contingency fund that they approved as well, which would be something like $100 billion to start with. In the future, if countries feel they are vulnerable under attack, their currencies under attack, they could ask for help from this contingency fund by the BRICS. In the beginning, it's going to be to help the five BRICS. In the medium term to longer term, it will be expanded to other developing nations. So if this happens like 5-6 years from now, and Argentina would be in the same position, they wouldn't have to pay extortionate interest to vulture funds like management in the U.S. They could, if they need money, if they need cash, if they need reserves, they could get it from this BRICS contingency fund.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, this is a long-term project, but at least now it's on the rails.
Okay, well, you know, two of the BRICS nations, of course, are Russia and China, and they have been sort of forming an alliance. And is this part of the – is a BRICS bank a way of being part of that? Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Is the BRICS bank – how does that relate to the Russia-China alliance?
Well, that's a much, much larger – in fact, because it's so interconnected, of course. What the BRICS are deciding in their meetings – and in fact, now there are constant meetings at ministerial level. They meet almost, practically every month before they have their annual summit. And they have long-range policies like the Development Bank and the Contingency Fund. The Russia-China partnership, which is in fact a strategic alliance, has also been evolving for the past few years. So now we have Russia and China united in all sorts of international fora. The BRICS, of course, the G20, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They coordinate with the non-aligned movement, which is over 100 countries. And it's an energy partnership. It's a strategic investment partnership. And this is something that I was able to see by myself in St. Petersburg 3 months ago, mm-hmm. at the St. Petersburg Forum. Integration between Russian and Chinese companies in terms of investment and in terms of China starting to develop Eastern Siberia as well. So this myth that, comes from the Middle Ages, of course, during Genghis Khan's times, in fact, that the Chinese are going to invade Siberia all over again. This is ridiculous. The Russians know it, that they need Chinese capital and Chinese investment to develop Siberia. They're already working on it. There is this energy partnership in terms of the huge gas deal that they signed 3 months ago, as well as other pipelines that are going to be built in eastern Siberia to go not only to China, but also to Japan and South Korea. So it's a multiple vector strategic partnership. And in terms of geopolitics, also is very important, because China and Russia are the forefront of trying to change the rules of the game as we have them now, which is the Washington Consensus. And they are supported inside the BRICS, and they are supported all across the global South. So it is, in fact, now a huge battle on many fronts. On one side, we have NATO. And on the other side, we have the BRICS and the global South. This is the big, big story, the way I see it, for the next 10, 20, 30 years, in fact, until the middle of the 21st century. Then we can have a much better picture of if we're going to have a new world order, multipolar, more respectful of international law, where you have a host of nations that are mid-powers, not superpowers, and they all have responsibility for managing the affairs of the world. This is where we're going. And obviously, once again, the masters of the universe, however you want to define them.
So they call themselves the international community,
too.
Die. You know, they call themselves the international community.
Exactly. International community, as is defined by Washington.
Right, yes.
Means NATO, essentially. And many countries inside NATO, they don't feel that they are part of it. And the rest of the world, which is what, 90% of the population of the planet and 90% of the countries represented at the UN, this is the real international community, and they don't have a voice in those decisions that are basically made in Washington. Like Europe is a random. Nowadays, it's more and more the way we see the behavior of the five big powers in Europe regarding what happened in Gaza, what's happening in Ukraine. It's an addendum of the U.S. They follow his master's voice, essentially. And the European population in these individual countries, more and more they see this clearly, clearly. But their voices are not reflected in mainstream media, in the big newspapers, in Italy, in France, in Spain, in the UK, for instance. But, you know, it's a slow, gradual change. But it's going to be an era of extreme conflict because, once again, the masters of the universe, the guys who really run the show, they are terrified because they see the world change in front of their eyes.
They see the dollar falling out, too.
War, austerity, intimidation, and, of course, sanctions.
Well, this is Fight the Empire, and our guest is Pepe Escobar, who writes the Asia Times and other publications. And, well, what about, how does this affect the dollar supremacy in the world?
Well, little by little, once again, the dollar is falling in terms of foreign exchange reserves. If you look at the charts month by month, the dollar is falling sharply month by month. It's still around 60% of global foreign reserves. It's still a lot. It's still the majority. Soon, it's going to get to 50%. And when I say soon, it's going to be before 2020, if not before that. Then we're going to have a real game changer because we're going to have the yuan more and more accepted as an international currency all over the world. They have swap agreements with very important places, financial places like Hong Kong, Singapore, Frankfurt, and London. Soon, all over Europe as well. Soon, yuan is going to be accepted in South America as well. In fact, in South America, you can use the Chinese paying system, UnionPay. Some important banks in South America already have agreements with UnionPay. This means that if you are a Chinese company, you can use the Chinese paying system or even have your Chinese credit card accepted all over South America, which is not, by the way, happening in Europe, only in a few European countries and a few European banks. So, you know, the rules are changing. The Russians are thinking of establishing their own parallel paying system. And they could even join UnionPay from China as well. So this means what? Visa and MasterCard, little by little, are losing their empire.
Let's talk about Ukraine. How does this relate to what's going on in Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine is a chapter in this enormous battle that is going on and will go on for the next decades, in fact. It's the battleground chosen by the Washington elites to fight against Russia. They identified Ukraine as the weak link in the Russian-speaking world or the Russian universe or the former Russian sphere of influence. So why not take the battle to the Russian western borderlands, which is Ukraine? So this explains everything that's been happening for the past, at least for the past 2 years, even more, since the previous Orange Revolution. The $5 billion that Victoria Nuland expressly admitted on the record that the U.S. spent in, between commas, advancement of democracy in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Exactly. The Maidan coup in February, you know, substituting one corrupt oligarch for another, but this one is totally following the orders from Washington, as well as his government, his former prime minister that resigned but is still there, Yats, as Vic Nuland call him, very good friend of the neocons in Washington, D.C. So this explains it all. And what's going on nowadays in eastern Ukraine, which is by every major definition, a slow motion and sometimes, you know, very high-powered ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers and Russians themselves who live in eastern Ukraine, which was always connected spiritually, culturally, linguistically to Russia. So basically we have extremely prejudiced, and in fact, a minority, but very powerful minority of neo-Nazis from Western Ukraine, and now in positions of power in Kiev, including Interior Ministry in the Security Services, trying to get rid of this 8 million Russian speakers and Russophones in Eastern Ukraine. This is something that you would never read it as it is in Western corporate media and Western press. It's impossible. The only thing that we see is demonization of Putin as the new Saddam, new Osama, new Hitler, whatever, mm-hmm. and demonization of Russia itself as a whole. You remember during the 90s, and then during the beginning of the Bush administration, the demonization of Iraq. Saddam at the time was Hitler, but not only Saddam was demonized, Iraq as a whole was dehumanized and demonized. Now we're seeing the process applied to Russia. But Russia is not Iraq. Mm-hmm. Russia is a nuclear power, a high-tech power, and if they are cornered, and if they see that their interests are being threatened lethally, they will respond, and it's going to be fulminating. And NATO knows this. NATO, in a war against Russia, NATO will lose in 24 hours. The Americans are not going to go to war against Russia, unless it is on European territory, and no Americans are involved, of course. Mm-hmm. So let them die for us. Once again,
well,
so
you know,
this is really, really serious. No wonder some of the best critical minds in the U.S. are now talking openly of a rush towards war.
Yeah,
and some European, very good European academics as well, they started to think in the same terms, especially Germans. And now that we know most of the German population, according to the latest poll, I think it's 57% and rising. They want a German foreign policy independent from the U.S., which means Europe taking care of itself. And this would mean in the medium term, the end of NATO.
Well, I was in
because
Germany.
Europe cannot take care of itself because Washington imposes NATO on the Europeans.
Isn't Germany working out an agreement with Russia? What's happening with that?
Well, this is something that leaked over a week ago. It's part of a sort of lots of discussions that the German government is having with the Kremlin. Of course, this is one possibility. But the terms of what they are discussing, they are not very good for Europe or for Russia, for that matter. Not to mention that Washington would never accept it. The terms of the agreement include Europe recognizing that Crimea is Russian, mm-hmm. which is a fait accompli. It's a fact on the ground already. And Russia paying reparations for taking Crimea back from Ukraine, and especially taking over for good the naval base in Sevastopol. They would pay something like roughly $1 billion for the Kiev government, which is not enough to pay their bills for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, for that matter. But Washington will never accept that. But if the Germans and the Russians reach some sort of understanding in the near future that excludes the U.S., this is the beginning of the end of this American plan to try to bring a NATO war to the Russian western borderlands. That's what it's all about Ukraine.
Well, what's happening with Kiev's war against eastern Ukraine? Because I've been hearing that Ukrainian army, they've had something over 400 deserters or something recently.
Yes. Absolutely. There was a mass desertion 2 days ago. They were very well treated. They were given an option. Do you want to stay here or do you want to go back to Ukraine? The majority wanted to stay in Russia, and like 100 and something, 60 or 70, they said, no, we want to go back to Ukraine. And God knows what's going to happen to them, because after all, they de facto deserted the Ukrainian army. And the Ukrainian army nowadays is not an army. It's a collection of militias.
Mm-hmm.
And advised by the U.S. government, by the way, they're going to, maybe sooner rather than later, they're going to be weaponized directly by the U.S. And their objective is to take over the Donbass regions, eastern Ukraine, for good. This means what are they going to do? They're going to exterminate 8 million people. That's the only way to take over that region. It's absolutely impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there is a refugee crisis caused by this NATO-advised, Washington-advised approach. According to the UN itself, there are practically 700,000 refugees already, some of them scattered in eastern Ukraine, and some of them crossing to Russia. The Russian government admits that 230,000 already crossed to Russia. So, you know, it's crazy. And the UN, obviously, they say there is a humanitarian crisis in eastern Ukraine, but they don't do anything about it because they are prevented by Washington to do anything about it.
Well, you know, it seems to me there's kind of a desperation here by the West. I mean, they seem to really be in a hurry to push this war as though, you know, their time is limited or something.
Yes, desperation, there's no question. First of all, because the Obama administration never had a Ukraine policy. Obama himself, he knows nothing about Ukraine. His advisors, which is a bunch of absolutely spectacular non-entities like Ben Rhodes and or Victoria Nuland inside the State Department, or, you know, these people are... It's not even a third rate intellectual terms, a bunch of advisors. At least, even the neocons had people who were at least smarter, even if they were completely warped or wackos. But at least they were smarter and relatively better informed than these people who are advising Obama. So, yes, it reeks of desperation. We have a neocon cell inside the State Department. Which is completely crazy.
How does Obama allow that?
In 2008, they thought they were voting for Obama to get rid of the neocons.
Yeah, why does Obama allow this?
Well, first of all, he's spineless. he doesn't know anything about foreign policy. Mm-hmm. It's just rhetoric. He's easily controllable. You can see by his speeches, especially this past few months, he doesn't even know what to say when he doesn't have a teleprompter in front of him. It reminds me of Reagan. Ronald Reagan, if he didn't have a teleprompter, he would be stalled, mute, you know, blank. It's the same thing with Obama. Mm-hmm. He repeats the same platitudes over and over again. He reveals a degree of disinformation about Russia and China, which is staggering in terms of a president. The latest interview he gave to The Economist, 5-6 days ago, It's the amount of stupidity that he talks about Russia and China is absolutely staggering.
It's embarrassing.
Especially because a few years ago, most of us, or if not the whole planet, were deceived by his rhetorical ability that, oh, this guy's intellectually prepared to be president of the United States. Not anymore. Not anymore.
Well, we got only about a couple minutes left, so why don't we talk just a little bit about what you call General Winter.
Well, General Winter is going to set in. We are in, not even mid-August now, right? Mm-hmm. By late September, I would say 45 days from now, General Winter sets in Ukraine. So what are we going to have on the ground? We're going to have, depending on how they keep conducting this ethnic cleansing in eastern Ukraine, Gazprom could turn off the gas, for starters, especially because they are not paying their bills. So we're going to have a freezing Western Ukraine population, Kiev included, practically starving, under IMF structural adjustment.
Oh boy.
With their salaries and their pensions frozen or if not decreasing.
Oh boy.
With no prospects of finding a job, and with their country ready to be plundered by these IMF vultures, already lent $15 to $17 billion. Nice. To the Kiev government, which is not enough.
I hear our music playing, and so I have to leave it at that. Something to look ahead to, and I hope we will have you back again soon to talk some more about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Pepe Escobar, who writes for the Asia Times and other publications. Look him up. Lots of good reading. So stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station, 1 minute before 10 o'clock. In 15 minutes, join us for Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 today on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones talks with author William T. Volman about his latest work, a collection of supernatural tales, last stories, and other stories. At 11:30, it's Black Book Talk with host Patricia Welsh. She'll speak with a Portland author who fled from Jamaica to try to build a better life for herself and her family, and has written a book called I Thought I Would Couldn't Tell It, a memoir of hard life and hope. That's all coming up right after Air Cascadia, which is up next. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Join us. Become a member of KBOO with your generous support for community radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rank in Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move you.